Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
Last week we ended with the sad news of what had happened to David's child, that promise given to David in verse 14, that nevertheless, because of this deed, you have utterly scorned the Lord, and the child who is born to you shall die. But we finished somewhat with, the hope, I guess you would say, the good news of hope in verse 23. But now the child, is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. And that somewhat of a light of hope in this story as we looked at last week. But then we see, the fourth part of this section, you might say, is the good news of another child in verses 24 to 25. Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went in to her and lay with her, and she bore a son, and he called his name Solomon. And the Lord loved him, and sent a message by Nathan the prophet. So he called his name Jedidiah because of the Lord. Now, we see this change, this good news, you might say, of this other child, but we need to be cautious that just saying that having another child then eliminates the bad news that once just was in verse 23. It's not then saying that having another child then replaces one child. Sadly, I think too many people who lose children and we seek to be able to comfort them in their loss, and we say things that can be somewhat hurtful, damaging. At least you have, we would try and point them to something that they do have that has not been taken away, you might say. Or if they were then fall pregnant again, well, then you have another child to replace the one that you lost. And that just is not helpful in those situations and times. Because you cannot merely just, one for one. It's not like that. Children are not like any other thing. You total your car and insurance covers and buys you a new car. They're replaceable. But children are not replaceable. They're quite different and unique. So often these words are not helpful. So we need to be cautious about how we do deal with that, because it ultimately doesn't deal with the true message of the gospel and hope, which is that we do lose loved ones in this life, that we do grieve, but we grieve as those who have hope, that this is not it and this is not the end. This doesn't even come close, but an example might be that you have your foot amputated off and someone comes up and say, well, at least you have another one. It's true, yes, you have 2 feet, but you kind of might have liked your other foot. So I think we need to be cautious about how we do, and even in this passage, to have the bad news and then to have the good news, it's not saying the good news then replaces the bad news. There's still grief to be had in this. But in here, we do see a shift in this narrative, a close to one thing and an opening to something new. And in this section, in these two verses, we see two changes that have happened in this narrative. We might have just glanced over this, but the first is that his wife, prior to this point, she has been Uriah's wife. But now we see two changes here. First is that it's David's wife. Prior up to this point, it's that David has taken her as a wife earlier at the end of chapter 11. But up to this point, she has really been referred to as Uriah's wife. Now, and also when I said that she had been Uriah's wife, that leads us to the second point. I don't mean to be offensive when I say she, as I've heard people say, that she is the cat's mother. You use a name there, but I didn't mean to be offensive, that we've often seen her in reference to other people. Uriah's wife, the first time that we met her and we found out her name was in verse 3. And David inquired about the woman, and he said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" That her relationship was to her father and then to her husband. But here, then, she is called Bathsheba again in verse 24. Up to this point, she's introduced in verse 3 of chapter 11 as Bathsheba. And up to this point, David's name has been repeated, Nathan's name has been repeated, but Bathsheba has always been referred to as she, or his wife, or Uriah's wife, always in this. So there's a change now in this shift, almost like this close of what has happened, and then going into the new chapter. So we see this change. But we also see now that Solomon is introduced. Solomon is born. That she bore a son and called his name, and he called his name Solomon. Now we have meant Solomon before, very briefly in chapter 5, in the second time where we get the growing of David's family tree, the growing of his concubines and wives. We commented on this briefly when we're looking at chapter 5, but David took more concubines. Again, notice concubines is first, and wives from Jerusalem, and he came from Hebron. And more sons and daughters were born to David. And these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shammua, Shoab, Nathan, and Solomon. So we've already met all these names before. And here is the second time we find out Solomon's name and how he came about. A passing comment in chapter 5, he took more wives and concubines, or concubines and wives, and then had more sons. And here Solomon is just mentioned in all this. But you come here to chapter 11 and 12, and you find a whole backstory about how he took more wives by murdering husband Uriah. Now, this is the only two times that Solomon's name is mentioned in 2 Samuel. So he's mentioned twice in chapter 5 and chapter 12. But we're also told not only he's mentioned twice, but here that he has two names, Solomon and Jedidiah. We're told why he's given the name Solomon in 1 Chronicles, chapter 22, verse 8. "And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, you shall have shed much blood and have waged great wars, and you shall not build a house in my name, because you have shed so much blood before me on earth." So we find out why David is not to build a house. "Behold, a son shall be born to you, and who shall be a man of rest. I will give him rest from all his surrounding enemies, and his name shall be Solomon, and I will give him peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish his royal throne in Israel forever." That Solomon, really, you see this name, Solomon and peace. He'll be a man of rest. He'll be a man of peace and quiet in the days of Israel. Solomon and Shalom. You can see how they're kind of similar sounding. And here that Solomon is a man of peace. So his name is Solomon. But we're also told in 2 Samuel chapter 12 that his name is also Jedidiah. And we're told that "And the Lord loved him and sent a message by Nathan the prophet, so he called his name Jedidiah because of the Lord." Now we see here something quite beautiful. The first thing is the Lord loved him. Now what has he done at this point? What has Solomon done? Nothing. Yet the Lord still loves him. What a glorious thing to think about, that however old he is when he's named, about 8 days, that we find out that the Lord loves him. What a great image that is for us when we think about children. And we can say, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." And you could point to this verse and say, well, the Lord loved Solomon even before he'd done anything. And he'll do some horrendous things, just like David did some bad things. He'll do some bad things. We might look at them another time. But here the truth is still the same, that he loves Solomon. what a great verse, but let's continue. Now, this is the only time that Solomon is actually called Jedidiah. And it seems that this is the name the Lord gives Solomon. But he's not called Jedidiah any other time in the whole Bible. Maybe David and Bathsheba didn't like it. Don't know. The only comment that I could find in any of the commentaries that seemed to be helpful was this, that said a number of people in the Old Testament, especially kings, had two names. So that in Solomon's case, one name might have been a private name, while the other had been a throne name. You might have this, that you're known to people in the professional sphere as a certain name, and then you have a name that is a term of endearment to those in your family or your friends that you grew up with. Maybe this is the case here, that Solomon is his public name that everyone knew him as, but in his house he was called Jedidiah. But we see from this time, from chapters 11 to 12, God's blessing on David and Bathsheba. Previously, David was the one who is loved, but now Solomon is the one who is loved, or Jedidiah. But we also see a connection not only between the love of God to David, now to Solomon. We also see maybe in this name, Jedidiah, this flowing on the promises of what it is. We've been told in chapter 7 that a son will be born to you who will build a house. We've looked at this. So this points forward, but there's no reference in 2 Samuel about it being Solomon, that we know from as we progress in the story who it's not going to be. But in 2 Chronicles, that's made in 1 Chronicles chapter 22, it's made clear that Solomon is the one who is going to build the house because he's a man of peace and rest. But in 2 Samuel, we don't get that hint. But there are some hints here that the Lord loves Solomon. But secondly, is in this name, Jedidiah. It's hard for us to be able to see, but you see, Jedidiah is a subtle hint that he's going to be the next David. And it's a little bit easier if we look at the Hebrew. You can see the Hebrew there for David. David is, you know, you can see those similar consonants and letters in there. And then Jedidiah, you know, Yadidiah. You know, you can see the D and the David type flowing, and that we kind of lose it in how we pronounce it. But as you can see how it's spelled, they look very, very similar with this tag along to those consonants there. Some things we just might never know. Why is he always just called Solomon and never Jedidiah again? God's providence. You can always again point to that statement at the end, because of the Lord. But you see here this flowing of this story. But what a whirlwind of a chapter. You think about chapter, just even chapter 12, going back to the end of chapter 11, when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead. She lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David done had displeased the Lord, and the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him, there were two men in a certain place, and one in the rich and the other the poor. But then you come to the end, and you can see even the similarities between this in verse 24 and 25. When David comforted his wife, again you see him comforting his wife yet once more, Bathsheba, and went in to her and lay with her, and she bore a son. Again, you hear that repetition of what happened before, the end of chapter 11. He called his name Solomon. And the Lord loved him. Now, what happened at the end of chapter 17? The Lord, the thing that David had done has displeased the Lord. But here, there's a change. The Lord loved him. A change is that repentance that we've looked at, that God's mercy and grace. And he sent by message to Nathan. What happened at the end of chapter 11, beginning of chapter 12? He sent Nathan to be able to go and confront him in this sin. And yet now he sends Nathan once more to be able to give this son a name. And he called his name Jedidiah because of the Lord. So what this this glorious chapter, in somewhat of a depressing But here you see this turn, this change from where we start in chapter 11 and chapter 12 to where we end in this section. Now we continue to move on to, I guess, the fifth point, war. What is it good for? Mentioned this before, the author of Chronicles saw this all as one story together. What we've looked at from the beginning of chapter 11 right up to this point, the author of Chronicles saw this as one story. If he was to remove the story, he couldn't just remove chapter 11 and leave chapter 12. He couldn't just remove chapter 12 and leave chapter 11. That chapter 11 and chapter 12 went together. That chapter 11 starts in the spring year, in the time when the kings go out to battle. David sent Joab, his servants with him, and all of Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. David remained at Jerusalem. And then, verse 26, and now Joab fought against Rabbah of the Ammonites and took the royal city. Now in 1 Chronicles chapter 20, we get what you might say is the cliff notes of this version. Then in the spring year, in the time of the kings go out to battle, Joab led out the army and revenged the country of the Ammonites that came and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem, very similar to what is 11 chapter 1. And then right to chapter 12 verse 26, and Joab struck down Rabbah and overthrew it. You see now here, he just cuts out that whole chapter 11 and chapter 12. And David took the crown of the king from his head. He found the weight, the talent of gold, and it was a precious stone, and he placed it on David's head, and he brought it out for a spoil of the city, and a very great amount, and he brought out the people who were in it, and set them to labor as saws and iron picks and axes. And thus David did to all the city of the Ammonites, and David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. So you see a condensed version of that story of chapter 11 and 12, that when the author of Chronicles removed this story, he removed all of that from chapter 11, verse 2, to 12, verse 25. He cut out that whole section. Now, when I noted in chapter 11 that there was a sin of David kind of staying, that David stayed in Jerusalem when everyone else went out. Even Uriah made that point that, why should I go to my house when everybody else is in booths or in an open field? So we begin at the end of chapter 12, that as everyone went out, now everyone comes back in, and David is returned with them in Jerusalem. Chapter 11 begins with David staying in Jerusalem and sending everyone else out. And chapter 12 ends with David coming back with all the people. There's, bookends to this. And we see this unity now in battle. No longer is David here and his army is over here, but there's unity in this battle in verse 29. And David gathered all the people together and went to Rabbah and fought against it and took it. So again, there's this division that happens, but now in chapter 12, there's unity happening once more. So what I want to do here is take a little bit more deliberate time, and hopefully briefly, teaching something that has come up several times in our discussion. The reason I wanted to do this is wanted to give a more thought-out answer to some of the questions that have been asked, rather than just this off-the-cuff response. Although I don't think I've said anything incorrect, sometimes I can just ramble on for a little bit and not actually directly answer the question. So hopefully this will be a little bit helpful. So I want to read this passage from verse 26 to 31. And then I want to talk about some of the ethics of this passage of when it comes to battles and things like that. So let's read verse 26 to 31. Now Joab fought against Rabbah of the Ammonites and took the royal city. And Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Rabbah. Moreover, I've taken the city of waters. Now then gather the rest of the people together and encamp against the city and take it, lest I take the city and it will be called by my name. So David gathered all the people together and went to Rabbah and fought against it and took it. And he took the crown of the king from his head, and the weight of it was a talent of gold. And it was a precious stone, and it was placed on David's head. And he brought out the spoil of the city, a very great amount. And he brought out the people who were in it, and he set them to labor with saws and iron picks and iron axes, and made them toil with brick kilns. And thus he did to all the city of the Ammonites. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. So here I want to ask three questions that kind of come up in these sections regarding what about war and battle? How do we understand what war and battle is? What about spoil and looting? What are then about labor and slavery? There are just three standard conversations that come up at the dinner table, obviously. First, before we get into the ethics of this, we need to understand that what we're reading is not an ethics presentation. What we're reading is historical narrative. So what this is descriptive of what has happened, not prescriptive of what should have happened, or prescriptive of what should happen in all these situations. And I think there's a great danger when we come in and we read passages, especially historical narrative, and then form that this is exactly how it should be done. We see this many times. I've pointed this out before that, what happens with those who take polygamy and marry multiple wives, often that is something that is denounced in the Bible. I think it's clearly taught in the Bible, but we don't necessarily see ramifications of that negative from those situations. And most of the time it's descriptive, not prescriptive. Just because Abraham had more than one wives doesn't then mean we should. It doesn't mean that should what had happened. So Stella and Calvin are at that age now where they're turning into little Pharisees, little lawyers. They're quite good. And one of the arguments they often try and make is that, well, Stella is doing it, or Calvin is doing it, the other sibling is doing it. And this is their argument. They did it, so therefore I should be able to do it. And often that's how people who come to passages like this, prescriptive, and treat it as prescriptive rather than just descriptive. The funny one is when they see Nora doing it, and they blame Nora. And they say, well, Nora's doing it. And it's not, well, Nora does a lot of things you probably shouldn't do. But that doesn't then help. The Bible does give us times where we clearly see in narratives the thing that David did displeased the Lord. We see this very clearly. But it doesn't always give us those comments. So I want to briefly look at what the Israelites were required to do by the law given from in Deuteronomy. So if you want to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 20, we might be able to understand a little bit more about how we can understand war, not just in a historical narrative. But we also need to understand that this law is given to the Israelites during a certain time, that we don't then come underneath this law, that we don't then just apply this law to our society exactly directly today. What we have is that the civil law is passed away, the ceremonial law is fulfilled, because Israel is no more. There's no civil need for the law for Israel. Because Christ has fulfilled the ceremonial law, what we have left is the moral law, which is summarized in the Ten Commandments. But what we can see is that the civil law is based on the moral law. So we can use the law to be able to understand how we might then be able to write laws for us today. The Westminster Divines call this the general equity thereof. So we look at the law and see that, there's sections of the law that write about parapets on roofs, putting walls on roofs so that people don't fall off and die. Now, we can look at this and there's a set height in here, but we can take this and say, okay, we should then maybe have laws in the land to be able to make people not fall off places and die. So handrails on decks and stuff like that. That would be a general equity thereof, not taking that whole law and then applying it, but taking the principle of that law. So we need to understand this. But we also need to understand that this doctrine on two different levels. That is, one is the fallenness of man. The law is then, what I mean, twofold. That the law is given by God to a sinful society. So what we see is divorce. Divorce is permittable in the law. That what's God's view on divorce? You can then say, well, the law permits divorce, But just because the law says it's permissible doesn't then mean it's advisable in all cases. Jesus explains that divorce was given because of man's sinful hearts. Matthew 19, verse 8. Because of your hardness of hearts, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. And from the beginning, it was not so. The reason why there's a law for divorce is because of sin and man's hard heart. So too with war. Why do we have war today? War is that flowing out of that sin of man's heart. Because we're sinners. Why do we have police with guns? Or because we're sinners. So when we turn to Deuteronomy chapter 20, we need to understand that this law is given because of that we are sinners, that we've got a conflict within this world that is not perfect, that we do hate our brothers, and that people do take things into their own hands. One of the first sins that is committed after the fall is the death of Abel. And law then doesn't then stop this sin. Law doesn't stop sin from happening, but it helps curb and protect others from sin. The second thing that we need to understand, that because we're sinners doesn't mean that everything works out the way it should. Just because you have a good understanding of what the law says doesn't mean then you are adequately able to apply the law in every situation. There's never been a war that has been perfectly led by men, because men are sinners. We have real men leading on the fronts of battle that have to make quick, decisive judgment calls. And those of us who are sitting in our armchairs years later have something to say, but really we don't. We have something that they might not have had. Correct information, more information. We have time to be able to make those calls. We have outcomes. So we need to understand that applying the law is quite different from understanding the law. That especially in times of war, you're relying on information that is coming to you from all different angles. And if you get incorrect information, it will affect your outcomes in an incorrect way. And I think those who study things like philosophy, especially philosophy of war and things like that, have one of the easiest jobs. You can look back at history and look at what could have or should have done. They don't need to apply it. Hypothetical situations are easy because you can make them up. They're not on the battlefronts. So as we quickly turn to Deuteronomy 20, I just want to quickly look at how this law given to sinners, applied by sinners, is to help us understand war in the Bible. We'll turn and try and understand these principles. Then doesn't make it binding, but might be able to help us to summarize the Ten Commandments and apply them in situations of war. We'll start with firstly verses 1 to 4, which is the Lord's presence. That the on the battlefront and on the ones that are fought and won or lost is based on this important principle. For the nation of Israel at this time, they were to be able to trust in God. And even a few men as a small nation would be able to defeat these great armies. And the reason they were able to do that was because the Lord was with them. Now, it's not to be assumed then that just because it says here, sometimes they would go into a battle assuming it would go their way because the Lord was with them. We saw this in 1 Samuel. They said, well, let us get the ark. That's how it's worked before. If we bring the ark into the middle of the battle, then we'll be able to win against the enemy. What happened? The ark was captured. Ichabod, the glory of God, had departed. Now, God was able to fight for himself in that situation. God was able to defeat the Philistines by himself. But the principle is that is not always the case that the Lord was with them. Often it was pride, idolatry. But it was always at the hand of God's providence. The second thing that we see in Deuteronomy 20 is, who shall serve? Who shall go and fight in these battles? A list of people that are to be able to serve and fight in battles. But then there's these exemptions of people that weren't to go and fight. Those who are dedicating a house, that have just spent all this time and labor building a house and they're about to dedicate it, they're not required to go on and fight. those who have recently planted a vineyard. They've spent all this time and energy. They've got to be able to enjoy the fruits of that vineyard. Those who are engaged to be married, they are to stay. But then there's also the fourth category of those who are fearful and faint-hearted. If you don't want to go fight in a war, you don't have to go fight in a war. It's actually not going to be a good thing, you know, going into war and having someone who's going to turn around and run away at the last minute. So here's four categories that those shouldn't. But then afterwards, after you've got these people who are who have been selected, or put their hands up, you might say, that faint-hearted, fearful clause gives a get-out-of-jail-free card for many of the people. But then after that, then you are to appoint commanders over the head. Important what the qualifications are for those commanders are that they're to be wise and discerning. Now remember back in 2 Samuel chapter 10, when Nashon, the Ammonites, the king died, and his son, Hanan, reigned in his place. Now what happened was that his commanders gave him foolish advice, saying that David was coming in to to spy on the land. He assumed the motives of David. So he was not wise and discerning. His officers were not wise and discerning. And then you can see that principle at work, that sinful, foolish men making decisions in war can lead to people's death and demise. Back to that second point, that the fall of men has an effect. But after all this has been selected, the Lord has been with you, and then you've selected your people who are going to fight, and your armies, we need to notice verse 10. Verse 10 is very important. That peace should be sought before fighting. Now you see this going out to battle, and then in verse 10 we see the first principle, before you engage in combat with anyone else, when you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. The first thing is that the best way to fight a war is not to fight a war at all. Here's a principle that needs to be applied, that just because war might be an option doesn't mean war is the best option. That peace should be sought first. You should do all that you can to try and bring peace between the nations, the cities, before you fight. So, peace, I think, is one big thing. And then, something that makes sense to us, verse 10, and then we hear verse 11. And this can be one of those verses that is harsh to our ears. And if it responds to you peaceably and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall be forced labor for you and shall serve you. So you come to this city, you offer peace, they accept those terms of peace, then what shall be happen to them? They shall be forced laborers for you. Now, I don't have time to be able to go down this rabbit hole. I think there's two things maybe quickly I could say, that the law had limitations to slavery. It wasn't then just to be exercised, whatever, that slaves did indeed have rights. Now, again, that slaves sounds strange to our ears, but we must understand that it was not then just a primitive free-for-all, that slaves were enabled rights. But all more accurately in terms, they were more treated as indentured servants. And this is maybe a term that you might hear today. Leviticus 25 speaks of the difference between Hebrew slaves and Canaanite slaves. But also, if a slave was to run away, again, this is one of the rights that a slave would have. If a slave was to run away, you should not go and get them back. But a slave had a right to leave, run away. And this is very unique in ancient Near Eastern laws, one that is often overlooked. And that is what makes it more like indentured slavery. That they run away and they live as a free man or woman after that. We see this in Deuteronomy chapter 23. You shall not give up to his master a slave who has been escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst, in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, whether it suits him. You shall not wrong him. So, again, you see this principle that if they were to run away, and they were to come to you, you're not to then go give them back to their master. You're to accept them and welcome them in. Well, that's an interesting thing to think about. And often you don't actually hear about the intricacies of the Jewish law during this time that you see this. Now, I'm not trying then to be able to justify slavery. I'm not seeking to have favor for a system which has slavery. But there's also many things that I don't want to go back to. I don't want to go back to having sheep and goats as currency to be able to pay. I'm quite happy to pay with dollars and cents. However, when I first asked Ron if I could marry his daughter, I said, "Well, what's your bridal price?" You know, and he was like, "Is this a cultural thing? What's the dowry?" He's like, "Is this a cultural thing?" And I was just messing with him, but you know, he's just those types of things are something that once was that we don't necessarily have today. So slavery is one thing in the law that, especially that I'm fine to be able to say that there's principles in here that we might want to apply to our life, but how you do that can be a little bit complicated. But remember what happened to the people of Jabesh-Gilead in chapter 11 of 1 Samuel. Nahash the Ammonite, different Nahash we think, went up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead, and all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Make a treaty with us." Again, what are they trying to do? They're trying to find terms of peace. And what are the terms of peace? "We will serve you. We'll become your slaves. It's better for us to be slaves to you than dead." This is what the terms of peace. They're realizing they're going to lose this battle. It's better for them to be slaves than it is for them to be that. But Nahash is not someone who's following the law of trying to agree to these terms of peace. "On this condition, I'll make a treaty with you. I'll gouge out all your right eyes and thus bring a disgrace in all of Israel." So what the leaders, the elders of Jabesh said, "Give us 7 days. Let us think about this for a little while." But you think about this situation. They offered and they would rather be slaves than be dead. Now again, that's hard for us to be able to hear and understand. But we do live in a day and an age where we have lots of laws and global laws and things that protect people's rights, and a country that protects people's rights. So some of these things are quite foreign to us. So before we get into laws of war, I want to point out that at least they had things written down, something to be able to follow. Now, we can pick and choose all you want. You can slam down things as much as you want, but at least something's written to criticize. And often when you get into discussions and debates with people, it's so easy to be able to criticize, but then once you say, "Well, how else would you do it? What would it look like?" "Well, we just don't go to war." Well, there's a flawed principle in that they don't understand the sinfulness of man. They don't understand that men and women have sinful hearts. So what do you do when someone tries to attack someone else? What do you do when someone's trying to take someone else's property? Well, what happens on that on a national scale? How then you apply things? Would you call the police if someone broke into your house? Most of them would say yes. Well, there you see a law, and the law has been applied to their life. What happens then on a larger scale? And often these then become politically motivated arguments about pro-war or anti-war. But that's not what you're talking about. You'd be able to apply these laws and ethics to particular situations. But I'm not trying to then make a political comment, but as an example, open or closed borders, that's often what you hear in political debate. But these terms are often not helpful. Because if you take them for their word, you're either saying the borders are completely closed or completely open. And I don't think anyone is arguing for those things. Now that might be specific, but again, in the nuance of the thing, when you're talking about pro-war, anti-war, you need to understand what that means. It doesn't mean you're pro-war in every situation. It doesn't mean you're anti-war in every situation, but how you talk about it. And often we don't even get past that. It's easy to be able to say you never have war. You always have peace. And I think that's a true statement. But it's unrealistic. And no one is saying that you have war and no laws and no rules. You just go and fight anyone you want. But at least the nation of Israel had some form of law to be able to guide them through wars that they would fight. And I think that's where verse 10 is an essential part of understanding Deuteronomy chapter 20. But then what happens in verse 12? You've sought to be able to make peace with them. They've returned their peace, and they say no to your peace in verse 12. But if it makes no peace with you and makes war against you, you shall go out and besiege it. Now again, here you see a nuance. You've gone to fight a battle, whatever reason that is, and they're the ones who end up making war against you. They've refused peace to you. Peace shall be sought. And I don't think then is that meaning you're making an impossible request to them. But peace is often about compromise, understanding, space. But then again, you go back to verse 1 in Deuteronomy chapter 20. Because of your enemies. Well, why are they your enemies? Again, it's not just what's happening here is everyone's just going out fighting anyone just because they want to. They're bored on Tuesday. They've got something to do. But then what happens after war? And just a few notes. Again, tough to be able to dissect in a modern age. Technology and discovery of the known world. But yet we've had two world wars. The First World War was actually just called the Great War. They just thought it was just a standoff war that was one of a kind. But eventually it had to be renamed World War I because there was yet another Great War, probably even worse than the first. They thought it would just be once in a lifetime. But even today, war is happening. Half of the time that America has existed, that it's had some form of war. The longest period of peace that has happened in America's history is about 30 to 40 years after the Civil War. It's just something that happens. But what they were to do after the war is they put all males to the sword. Now, what I believe this is saying is not that they just put any male to death, but any soldier, a combatant, that they're putting them to death. Then they are to take the women and the children, livestock, and take them as plunder. Again, you separate them from combatants. The other option, they sought peace, but now, what do they have? Again, it's easy to point at, but then how do you apply it, I think, is very difficult to be able to understand. Now, we do have then specific instructions about the time of the conquest that we're given in verse 18. This is a very specific time that in verse 18 that you may not teach you to do anything according to their abominable practices that they have done for their gods. And so you sin against the Lord your God. Now again, we can't understand God's mind, which is an important distinction of understanding war and murder. This is why motive is a huge part of any understanding of a murder case. It's not merely that someone died. It's the motive behind that murder. We have first, second degree levels. We have incidental accidents. And that law applied, that justice applied, would be different. So we can't then place God in the dock because we don't understand his motives. Now, I don't understand this, but I'm not a holy, perfect judge, and I therefore am lenient. My sin gives leniency to other sinners. Or to put it another way, God deals with me in grace. So on one hand, we want God to be gracious with us and not punish us according to our sins. But often what we want in that situation is we're happy for God to punish others and bring justice to others who punish us. So here, again, I think it's a very specific instance and what they're actually doing, those abominable practices, often were child sacrifices in these countries. What they would do is they'd offer their children. living children to their gods, Molech and others. And thus, I think you can see some form of judgment on God's part. Interestingly, in verses 19 and 20, you see an interesting thing about not cutting down any trees. Now, this seems to be a strange law, but again, I think it shows the importance of war as a temporary, short-term thing, that it shouldn't have a lasting impression on the area. It should just be for a time, that it shouldn't devastate years later. A battle might last months, but it should not have a whole area then eliminate it. So that's a quick look at Deuteronomy 20, but that's not our law today. Again, it helps us apply principles. But I want to take a look at these principles and maybe turn to maybe smarter people than I have sought to explain what is called the just war theory. And there's three main thoughts of what just war is. This is from Nigel Biggar, and he explains these three main principles of what just war is. The first is that it has to have a just cause. You can't just start a war for no other reason. But what he says is you need a grossly injustice thing to be able to occur. That something horrible has to have happened. And that something horrible can't just be that they looked at me funny. You know, that they're killing innocent civilians. You think about Adolf Hitler and the Jews. There's a gross injustice. Secondly, that the war will stop this gross injustice. Just because this gross injustice happened and you go and fight this war, but that war is not going to solve the gross injustice. Often the motive then can be changed to be able to say, this is my reason. But if you're not actually going to stop the gross injustice, then there's no purpose in going to war to be able to stop that gross injustice. It's not just an excuse to be able to say, well, I didn't like Hitler anyway, so I'm going to use this as an excuse to go and attack him. It must stop. The purpose of the war must be to stop this gross injustice. And then thirdly, the war needs to be discriminatory. And what this is a good type. That you understand that war then doesn't just wage war on everybody. You separate those that are civilians and those that are combatants. And you separate that you seek to minimize those and not bring harm to those who are civilians, but deal with mainly the combatants. Now, these things rightly understood is what you would say a just war is. That there's a gross injustice. Going to war would stop this gross injustice. The going to war to stop this gross injustice would only cause harm to those who are fighting against to support this gross injustice.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.